Subject is David Rojas, and the interviewer is Jose Angel Gutierrez. We're in Eagle Pass, Texas, in the Best Western. This is June 9th, 1996. It's approximately 8:30 p.m. And we're going to grant an interview voluntarily. You were giving up your rights to your image and your persona and your likeness and stuff, because this will be for educational purposes, not commercial. The unedited interview and transcription will be placed in the special collections of the University of Texas at Arlington Library. This is a research project for research in the Mexican-American politics. You consent to the interview?
Yes, sir.
Voluntarily?
Voluntarily.
All right. Why don't we start off with a little biographical sketch? Why don't you tell us who you are, your parents, maternal, paternal, where they came from, and how you got here?
English, Spanish.
It'd be easier to transcribe in English.
My parents are Gregorio Riojas and Irena Riojas, who came from Piedras Negras. I was born here in Eagle Pass. I've lived in Eagle Pass all my life, with the exception of the times when I went to the University of Texas at Austin, where I got a BA degree in ethnic studies and political science. I was out again for 3 years when I attended law school at Texas Tech in Lubbock, and I've been practicing as a lawyer since 1984 in Maverick County.
Who were your grandparents on your father's side and your mother's side?
On my father's side, I come from a family of bakers. My grandfather on my father's side was Antonio Riojas, and Juanita Riojas, and they were originally from Monclova, Coahuila, and moved to the Piedras Negras, Eagle Pass area, and they lived in Cristal, Carrizo, Asherton, Del Rio, Brackettville, opening up bakeries throughout the area. And when my grandfather became bored with the area, he'd move on. And eventually, my father stayed here in Eagle Pass. On my mother's side, is Enrique Gonzalez and Irene Gonzalez. They were originally from Guerrero, Coahuila, and they operated a little butcher shop in Piedras Negras, and my mother was a seamstress, and met my father after World War II and got married and eventually moved to Eagle Pass and raised a family here.
Brothers and sisters?
I have an older sister, Maria Elena Riojas Lester, who works with the Texas Education Agency. I have a younger brother, Gregorio Jr., who works with Motorola in Austin. And I have a younger sister, Irene, who works with the Texas Department of Health.
And you're married now? Got your own children?
I'm married to Norma Jimenez, and we have one son, Roberto, who married early and has made me a grandfather at a very young age. I have three grandchildren, Roberto Jr., Jose Antonio, and Jorge.
Lots of Riojas is to come. All right, well, tell us about your political history. Were you active in Austin or before, or how did you get into politics?
I became active in politics in my senior year in high school. It was during the times of El Movimiento, and that was 1972 when Ramsey Muñiz was running for governor, and I had some friends who were involved in politics, La Raza Unida, at state level, Choco Gonzalez Mesa, and René Barrientos, who's an attorney now, and Raimundo López, who had just gotten out of the army and became involved in Movimiento politics. And they brought Ramsey Muñiz down to Eagle Pass, and I heard Mr. Muñiz and liked the ideas that he was talking about. And I've been active ever since. At that time, we did the voter registration. We get out the vote drive for Mr. Muñiz and the Raza Unida candidates. And we've continued in different forms in one way or another throughout the years. When I was at the University of Texas, I was involved in the Mexican American Youth Organization. I was president for 2 years, my junior and senior year there, and we engaged in a variety of activities, including protests regarding affirmative action, and some of the policies that were eventually adopted were some of the stuff that we were working on at the time when we took over the president's office back in 74, 75, and we were talking about the same ideas that are now under attack by the Republican administration and the courts. And a lot of the people that I met at the University of Texas that were also involved also with the continued political activities, and we've always been in contact, so más o menos we always know where we are statewide, and trying to main contact and make sure that some of the same policies that we were talking about back in the 70s become a reality.
When were you born?
I was born in 1953.
What prompted you to come back to Eagle Pass?
Well, it's a long story. They say that once you drink Rio Grande water, that it's hard to let go. And my family was here at the time I decided to come back after graduating from the University of Texas, and there was a lot of the changes that I wanted to see implemented in my community, and I came back to see if I could play a part in some of those changes. Even after law school, one of the primary reasons I went to law school is because I got frustrated at some of the changes that we wanted to see were not taking place, and that I felt that as an attorney I could grease the wheels a little bit better. And when I was graduating from Lubbock, people would ask me what my plans were, and I'd tell them that I was returning back to Eagle Pass. And they thought it didn't make it sense, because at the time, back in 84, was after the first devaluation of the peso, and Eagle Pass was very much in the news regarding the serious unemployment and really economic disaster that was taking place in the county. And most of my law school friends would say that would be reason not to return, but I felt that that was something that motivated me to return, because these were my friends, my family that was in need of assistance, and that's why I always returned back, because of those people that live here in the community.
Were your brothers and sisters also involved politically, or you were the only one?
My sister was involved in the Awareness Club in Southwest Texas Junior College in Uvalde, and the Mexican American Youth Organization at the University of Texas at Austin. But that was about the extent of her activities at the time. Since then, None of my brother or sisters really care for politics.
So what were some of the first lessons you learned about politics in Maverick County?
Well, Maverick County has a history of being one of the communities in the South Texas area that was run by a patron system. We had Judge Roberto Bibb, who pretty much ran the county for some 20, 30 years before anybody else could have a say-so in politics. And at the time, back in the 70s, at the time his empire was crumbling, and his death came soon afterwards. But one of the first things I learned is that in politics, it doesn't really matter how much an individual can access and get elected. It really is a system that works in conjunction, and that it's very difficult to do any type of political activity on an individual level, and that organization was very important in order to getting change accomplished.
Can you describe some of those last years of Bibb? You said it was crumbling. Was there, and it was a patron. Who were some of the lieutenants, or how come they didn't succeed in taking over, or what happened?
Well, part of the problem was that when some of the people from the community were going into the service and coming back, they were also interested in having a say-so in government. And while he was still able to control government during the second part of the Second World War, after the Korean and Vietnam veterans came back into the community, that there was some resistance in terms of falling into that patron system, and that people had their own independent thoughts about what should be done in Maverick County. And it's pretty much what was happening at the time, that people were now becoming active outside the sphere of the Bibb circle. And when people who were a little bit more educated and had ties to the community were becoming involved, Judge Bibb was not as successful in retaining control. And so I think it was a combination of education and being exposed to other areas outside of Eagle Pass that made it difficult for Judge Bibb to retain control.
You called him Roberto Bibb. Was he an Anglo or a Mexican?
He was an Anglo, but he was born in Rosita, Coahuila. His father was one of the managers of the iron plant in Rosita, and when he was born, I guess they I really don't know if his real name was Roberto or Robert Bibb, but everybody here called him Roberto, because even though he was an Anglo, he spoke Spanish, and that's why he was able to exercise so much control over people's lives here, is that he was able to interact not only with the money element of on the Anglo and business side, but he was also able to interact with the working class and Mexicanos.
Did he lose an election, or did he quit? Where did Ramon Salcedo come in?
right. Ramon Saucedo was part of his lieutenants.
I see.
And he was one of the politicians that he was able to use when people were getting a little bit rowdy. He started letting others into his circle, and Ramon Saucedo was one of those persons that he let in. Roberto Bibb lost an election to Dan McDuff, who, when the Anglo establishment felt uneasy with Roberto letting in people like Ramon Saucedo and Albino Maldonado and some other Mexicanos that were not part of their group, and so they ran a race against him, and the Anglo establishment at that time won over Roberto Bibb. Eventually, Ramon Saucedo became, well, after Dan McDuff beat Roberto Bibb, and this I'm talking about the 60s, Dan McDuff ran for re-election, and Roberto Bibb ran again, and he won again. Eventually he died, and Ramon Saucedo, who was a county clerk at the time, was named as the interim county judge, and eventually he became county judge for, I think he was judge for about 8 to 12 years.
There was another county clerk, no? Enrique Flores, Enrique Lopez?
Enrique Lopez. Enrique Lopez was one of those individuals who came back and was dissatisfied with Roberto Bibb's political power, and he was a county clerk for a time, and he was one of those who resisted and was seeking change in the political system.
Now, did the county judge and power in the county control the city, or is that another faction, another group, and the school board? How does that play out?
Well, at the time, everything was controlled by Roberto Bibb. Since Roberto Bibb's death, what has happened now is that we have two competing factions within the community, and one is the old Roberto Bibb legacy, and the other is the new Frank Chisholm, Rudy Bowles, the young guys who came in after Vietnam and started getting involved in politics. And so those two factions have been going back and forth over the years, and at times, Vesigo, the city's controlled by the Frank Chisholm group, at times it's the Saucedo, and really the English, Daisy Diaz English, and Bertie English, Cantu, are some of the people who were involved with Roberto Bibb, who really control the politics on the Ramon Saucedo and Bibb side.
Now, how does one do politics in Maverick County? The school board, city council, county government, how is it done?
Well, the way that traditional politics play out in Maverick County, it's through an established system of political workers, and they're all female, las trabajadoras, la política, and what they do is they have a social service type system that they've implemented over the years, where they help people go get groceries, fill out forms, and several types of assistance in exchange for votes. And when the election comes around, these political workers offer their services to the candidates for a fee, and they'll deliver X amount of votes. And the system has pretty much been effective as of this date, in that those political workers basically control the outcome of the absentee or early voting, as it's called now, and results, in that they're able to mobilize a large segment of the voting population to the polls, and this pretty much controls the outcome of the election, because it's very difficult to overcome the numbers that are already in the ballot box when election day comes around. And so basically whoever has the money to hire the most political workers gets elected.
Is this a legacy from BIB, or was that the...
This is the legacy from BIB. In the past, what these political workers would do was whatever assistance people needed, they would go to Roberto BIB and say, well, this person needs medical assistance. He would use the county funds to assist them, but indirectly through these workers, so that they would get the credit, and they could then in turn deliver the vote for
este. Do they have a certain name in Spanish?
Nomás las trabajadoras, eso es what they're called.
Okay. And I take it that that these are by piece rate. I mean, do these people get paid by the vote they turn out, or contract fee, or
they get a weekly fee per candidate, plus an additional amount, depending on the importance of the election, of the number of votes that their voters that they're able to carry into the polls. And if their candidate wins, then they get a bonus.
Can we put some dollar figures here? I mean, how much? What's the going rate for a week, and what are the bonuses like?
The minimum is $250 a week. And with one particular voter now asking for $1,000 a week and $10 a vote, and then depending on the importance of the election and the money that's being generated, a bonus between $300-$400.
So these workers can actually rent out to several candidates and make a killing. So election times are good harvest season.
Yes, it's a very lucrative area.
How does the national and state elections get translated into here? Who runs those, and how does that money filter down?
Well, it's through the heads of the different organizations. I call it the Chisholm and the English faction, and they make contact with the state and national candidates and try to get their share for running a campaign. And what happens most of the time is that really doesn't translate to much for state and national candidates, that they use the money for their own local races. But to a certain extent, this is still a very democratic county, in which democratic politics really don't, the Democratic Party doesn't have anything to worry about in Maverick County, because they always pull through for the Democratic Party. Very few Republicans have been able to make even a small dent in Maverick County.
But doesn't Bonilla represent this district? And yes. He carries Maverick, huh?
No, he hasn't carried Maverick.
Oh.
He was able to make a dent, but he got a sizable amount. But that was because he was able to get the support of the English camp. And so, but he did not carry Maverick County.
I see. All right, so when were some of the first campaigns you worked with? You talked about Ramsey Muniz, and so that was a challenge to the Democratic Party. How did the rest of the party do here in this area?
Ramsey in 1972 carried Maverick County. And that came about with the Frank Chisholm faction at the time also supported Mr. Muniz, and while they were supporting Mr. Muniz, they did not affiliate with the Raza Unida party. At the time, during the primary, there were 100 of us that voted in the Raza Unida primary, and those 100 people have grown over the years, we are a third party faction within Maverick County, and we've grown over the years, and the first election that we went against the two system was back in 1978 when I ran for mayor, and we had Johnny Soto, who ran for the school board, and we were able to garner 45% of the vote against a very strong candidate for mayor at the time was Eddie Rodriguez. Was very influential not only in Maverick County but in the region, and for a race in which we first ran locally with minimal funds, I think we spent something like $300 at best, and we got 45% of the vote, which at the time was 800 votes, and we ran several other candidates over the years but we didn't do very well until we didn't really gain momentum and reorganize until back in 1992 when we ran slate for the city, and in which I ran for mayor, and we were able to garnish 48% of the vote, and we didn't do as we thought we could do, but then in 1993 we ran a slate for city council, and I was elected on the city council and against another strong candidate, which was Hector Tolín Garza and Francisco Villa. Oscar L. Rodriguez was elected along with me in 1993 for the city council. And we've been trying to make a dent not only in terms of what happens in city council, but the way elections are run. We did not use the trabajadoras. We did not pay for votes, and we've been able to minimize the importance of las trabajadoras in that we have volunteers and people who can do the same thing without prostituting their influence, that they're interested in the same ideas that we want to accomplish and work as effectively as las trabajadoras without compensation. And so not only have we been able to minimize the importance of these trabajadoras, but we are also getting issues involved in campaigns. Because in the past, before 92, I just said before 1990, issues were never discussed. It was solely a personality contest. And only those involved in politics, which was minimal because politics was very tight-knit with a few people in each of these factions getting involved. And they controlled all the boards and stuff, and the same people on all the boards and all the elected positions. And so only those people knew what the real issues were involved. It was never made public. And since 1990, when Enriqueta Diaz Lane at the time, as the Ranford County judge, was the first time we had a debate and which issues were discussed. And Enriqueta was running then as a Democrat against the incumbent judge Rudy Bowles, who was a very strong candidate, very, very likable person, who nobody thought could be beat. And at the debate, Enriqueta was able to beat him in the debate and eventually won the election. And since that time, this third faction of politics has been able to pressure candidates for public office into discussing issues. And it's made a difference in terms of turnout. This past mayor's election, we had a record number of votes. We had close to 4,300 people coming out to vote for city elections. Well, the previous the county election, I think they had something like 5,000 votes countywide, and so we were able to garnish just in the city alone close to 4,300 votes, and we broke a record from the previous election by almost 1,000 votes. And these are people who have been registered for a long time, who had not been participating because they did not feel that their vote had any impact and that it wouldn't make a difference. And so we were able to get those people to come out and vote. We were unable to win the election, but we're getting closer each year. This year, I got 1,900 votes, which is twice the amount since I started back in 78. And one of these days, we're going to be able to surpass the amount of people that come out to vote on their own and beat the trabajadoras, which is what happened this time, that we lost the absentee by close to 350 votes. And we won election day, but we were not able to overcome the difference. And we are making the system analyze what they're doing, because what's happening is that the trabajadora system is becoming very expensive. With the number of votes that are coming out on election day, as they go, they have to mobilize more people to get out the vote on the absentee. And it's becoming a very expensive proposition. This past election alone, the mayor's race itself, Mayor Rogelio Flores, is estimated to have paid close to $60,000. Our campaign was we spent $5,000, and so it's becoming a very expensive proposition for them to maintain the system, and we think we can break it.
You refer to yourselves as the third faction. Do you all meet? Do you have a name, or do you, you gather formally sometimes to talk about these things? Or?
Yes, we don't have a name, but basically we're an offshoot of the Raza Unida party and the union movement here locally. The Salant Company at the time, Mosaic's founder, went through a unionization effort back in the late 70s, in which a lot of working people became involved in union politics and eventually the national politics through labor unions and stuff that have tried to make a difference for working people here locally, and so that we were able to get both groups working in the same direction and organized, and we have regular meetings mostly involved regarding what's happening locally and analyzing and trying to get fundraisers going so that we can raise those $5,000 to their $50,000 to $60,000.
How do you raise money?
Plate sales, raffles, garage sales, just the traditional fundraising for.
And do you all do voter registration?
We do voter registration.
By yourselves, or do you tie into the San Antonio outfit? Or?
We did. Back in 94, we tied into the Southwest voter registration, but basically we do it on our own. We don't get priority from the Southwest voter registration because we are 90% Mexicano, and most of our races are involving two Mexicanos, and so we don't get prioritized.
Let me take you back for a moment to the BIP days. Who was the Anglo power structure back then?
Well, it was mostly the business and ranchers, cattlemen, and
they have names.
Yes, the Ritchies, the Rosenbackers, Fitch. It's been so long. I haven't talked about this in ages, but it was the WIP, Wheasties. It was mostly Anglo.
What's left? Who is the local Anglo power structure now?
Well, back in 93, we basically got rid of the old Anglo claimed the politics through the city boards. What happened over the years through city charter, the members of the bridge board, water board, which were the revenue producing entities for the city, were controlled by the boards for these entities. And they were a self-perpetuating board, and we had people there up to 93 who had served 24 years, 18, I think the youngest one was 12, but he had inherited his position on the board when his father died. And so we had all these Anglos, Rosenbackers, Fitch, I forgot the other guy's name, but the Anglos had pretty much gotten control of the revenues, and they were holding back all the revenues because we had gotten control of the majority of the city council. And what we did is we had a charter amendment to do away with the self-perpetuation of boards and have them subject to city council appointment and term limits, and we were able to get the charter amended and we got rid of.
But the Anglos definitely still are a power to reckon with. They vote with the English Cantu faction, or
English Cantu mostly.
Uh-huh.
And what happens is that because of their numbers are not significant, the only way that they are able to retain influence is through money. And so, as the system of the trabajadoras is financed mostly by the Anglo establishment and Mexican interests, that is a new player in local politics that while we're on the border and we've been sister cities and get along fine, what has happened lately is that there's a pre-controlled faction of Piedras Negras politics who are interested in several projects, one of them being the Second International Bridge, which is we've just received the presidential permit for, but they are particularly interested in the location itself, and where on the Mexican side we have private investors who will receive the concession for the operation of the bridge and have bought all the adjoining land where the traffic is going to be going through and developing, and so they are very interested in seeing that the bridge be built in a specific there. Location. And so the location is not the best one for Eagle Pass. While it may be suitable for Piedras Negras, it is located next to a park, a civic center, a elementary school, hospital, and the livestock show barn, the medical clinic, and all these areas are going to be affected. Most of them will have to be torn down in order to accommodate the bridge site. And so it's a losing proposition for the Eagle Pass side in terms of investment and being able to recoup all these costs. And we had a lot of problems with the federal government approving the site. It wasn't until the city administration agreed to finance everything with local dollars and not receive state or federal assistance that we were able to get the presidential permit. But this was one of the main issues that has come up in city politics since 92, and the financing was the critical issue at this time around for city elections. And the Mexican investors pumped most of the money that was used in this election, because I made very clear that the financing for the bridge was not going to be done solely through city dollars, that we could not afford to do that. And so the Mexican investors funded the Mr. Mayor Flores, who got elected, he had a Mexican union official was present at the voting site every day, making sure that their investment was protected, making sure the ladies were bringing in the votes that they were paying for. So I think it was the first time that they were very open about their participation in city politics, and which we have Mexican politicians controlling what happens on this side of the border.
Well, this relationship of cities on the border, Eagle Pass included, is symbiotic, no? I mean, there's a lot of involvement on both sides. A lot of economic interests, a lot of cultural interest, a lot of family ties. You yourself pointing out that your family is partially on the other side at one time. How does that dynamic play out? I mean, all these issues beyond the border are extreme issues of concern to people. They're afraid of all the Mexicans coming over and so on, drugs and crime and disease and pollution. How does that play out here in Eagle Pass?
Well, it's something that, it's difficult to assess from a general public perception, in that we have a growing sentiment that people from Piedras Negras are enemies, that they cross into Eagle Pass to get our jobs, because we have people who are daily commuters who come and work in most of the downtown businesses hire 95% of the workers from Piedras Negras. We have the last clothing factory that's operating here, where I would venture to say 60% of the people are from Piedras Negras. And the agricultural labor pool is 75% from Piedras Negras. And so the natives of Eagle Pass feeling the economic crunch are looking towards solutions for employment, and seeing that all the jobs are going to Mexican residents has caused a rift between not only the two cities, but families. And we interrelate so much that it's difficult say that this is what's happening, but in reality the analysis that's out there in the general public is that they are invading us, and even though they may be our cousins and friends, we have a very limited job market out here, that it's becoming brother against brother.
And Piedras Negras is about five times the size of Eagle Pass, no? Now, don't they do most of their shopping here?
Well, see, up to a certain amount of the economy here is very largely sales, retail sales, and to people coming in from Piedras Negras and Monclova and Sabina, Zaragoza, and the surrounding Cinco Manantiales area. And so there's a love hate relationship that we enjoy their business, and we enjoy the culture, the friendship, culture, but when it comes down to economics, they're a threat.
In the last, I'd say 16 years, it seems like the county judges get one term. What has been going on there with the succession of county judges after Saucedo? They seem to be able to hold on just one time, like for example, Enriqueta, Diaz, Lane?
Well, part of the problem is economics. We have seen the county become saturated with colonias, and the county not being able to address the problem because of the economics, that they have a very poor tax base, and sales taxes has decreased significantly because of the peso devaluation, and we have a very poor job market, and so things are not very well economically here, and so when you have a very limited budget and an overwhelming amount of problems that need tax dollars to remedy them, you have a lot of voter dissatisfaction. And so I'm sure I can almost predict that Judge Escobedo will not get reelected. Every month we have people coming in from the colonias with just very basic needs that they have, and the county not being able to address them. Just this past week, we have a subdivision called, ironically, Green Acres, which they have no water. They have a water line that's crosses the main road leading into the subdivision. They have sewer line running next to it, but they can't get hooked up because they haven't been platted, and they've been that way for close to 16 years, and people have been waiting on promises from the different county commissioners and county judges that the problem is going to be remedied as soon as they get in. They get in and doesn't get remedied, and they get booted out. And so the colonias issues is something that really is gonna predominate county politics for a long time.
Well, doesn't the county have the option to go to home rule and set up police powers over zoning and development and those kinds of things?
Well, now they have that option, but they inherited the subdivisions have been around for close to 20 years, and it's ironic how when Dan Morales talking about the colonias problem, and he's got a colonias task force, and saying that government is going to have to address these problems. Well, because the developers are no longer around. Well, here in Maverick County, I can speak from personal knowledge, the people that developed all these colonias, if you can call it development, are still around. They're Nick Carr, Chilo del Rodriguez, which is Rudy Ball's uncle, Isidro de los Santos, who is one of the Frank Chisholm, Rudy Ball's faction supporters. And we have all these people who are still around, but apparently they've disappeared politically they've disappeared. They caused the problem, but now they're no longer around, yet they benefited. And these past county judges, specifically Ramon Saucedo and Rudy Bowles, permitted the proliferation of the colonias because they profited from
it. Who is your senator, state?
Our state senator is Frank Medla.
All the way from San Antonio. And your state rep?
Pete Gallego.
Alpine. How does that work, that you're connected to a senator in one direction and a state representative in the opposite direction just about?
Well, when the legislature decided to draw up the lines, they looked to see how Mexicanos could get elected, and lumped us in a certain area where that we have a very diverse area that's being represented, and we wind up with people whose communities tend to take them away from these problems. Frank Medla has been representing us for 2 years now. I think he was here this weekend. I think this is probably the second time around. He hasn't been here. Pete Gallegos, Alpine, the only time we see him is when elections come around. But they're both tied in to the political factions here, and they support him because they can maintain, as you go, some of those financial resources that these candidates can offer, and they're looking for self-serving interest and not seeing that these community interest gets resolved.
What are some of the issues you see important here in this area?
Well, economic development is certainly the top priorities. Where we have seen that in the past, Chamber of Commerce, the Maverick County Development Corporation, and city and county government have always looked towards trying to attract industry from other areas, and have devoted a lot of time and effort to bring in industry from other places, and they have failed to internalize this, the limited funds that we have in generating our own economy. We have several local businesses that could develop into bigger enterprises had we devoted our efforts. One of the things that I think may be attractive in the very near future is the pecan industry. We have a large number of pecan groves in Maverick County, but we see very little of the profit from those pecans, because the only thing that happens in Maverick County is that they cultivate the pecans and send them for shipping in its raw state to other areas where they are shelled and processed, and the added value to the pecan is lost to other communities, and I think that with the shift in national politics regarding farm subsidies, I think we may see a resurgence of agriculture in the area, where since the late 70s we have seen minimal agricultural area, though this is part of the winter garden, and we had large farms that cultivated all these winter crops in the past, that they were collecting subsidies from the government and not growing anything. And so I think that the agricultural side of the local economy may see some change in the very near future, but we have to try to cultivate is the processing side of it, in order to is to keep as much of the profit from the raw product here locally. And I think that that may materialize. Who knows what happens with farms and agriculture and these corporations and stuff taking over farms. I really don't know what effect it's going to have here locally, but we anticipate that may be something that may result in the future.
How about the Kickapoo Indian politics and politics of bingo and all of those things that we read and heard about for many, many, many years out of Maverick County? What was all that about?
Well, at this particular point, it seems like at least we'll have a bingo hall, a high stakes bingo. I don't know whether state officials will actually let a casino come and to play here in Maverick County. The Tiwas have really experienced a lot of legal challenges to their operation, and we have the Kickapoos here who were just recognized in the early 80s as a tribe, who may not be able to play the state level politics as probably as well as the Tiwas. And so I don't know if we'll be able to get the casino going, but I think we'll probably see a high stakes bingo. I think if that comes about, I think we will see an increase in activity in Maverick County, specifically money coming in from hotels and stuff. But I think in terms of jobs and the kind of jobs that would allow someone to really be able to support a family is not really there. They're mostly service jobs and mostly minimum wage paying jobs that are needed, but they're not gonna resolve anybody's financial future for them.
Who is the leadership within that group? Is it the Kickapoos themselves, or they've hired, there was a fellow named Sailors, no, one time, who was the director or something?
Right. Yeah, well, Dale's gone, Dale Sailors is gone, and we have the Rudy Bulls people are pretty much in control now. Well, the tribal council, Raul Garza, Estel, Juanico, Miguel Garza, those people are there. Basically, the operations are being run by Mexicanos, and they're mostly the Rudy Bulls faction people. Instead of Isidro Garza, who was a city manager for the city of Eagle Pass at one time, he's an engineer, is pretty much the one that's running the show now there for the casino. And most of the high-paying supervisor jobs are all held by their people.
The other significant issue some time back was this rerouting of the traffic around to the mall and bypassing the downtown area. Who was responsible for that decision back when, and how has it played out?
Right, well, it was the downtown merchants and the Anglo establishment against the Rudy Bulls faction, Manchas, people along the area which the overpass actually passed through. And it worked out in terms of business adapting to the changes, they were not able to compete with them all, and so they found markets and selling other items that are not available at the mall. There's a bunch of trinkets, dollar stores, and stuff. And it was controversial for a small period of time. It didn't really materialize to be that serious in terms of the downtown business impact that they had foreseen.
So the banks are still there, and the drugstores and the department stores that were high class, and all that's still viable there.
Well, the Riskin's is still there, which is the downtown store with a little bit more recognition in terms of quality clothing. But the other stores, just readapted and are there. They all the Anthony's and Pennies, Bells, and stuff have moved to the mall. Those stores are now we have a lot of Korean imports and stuff that are now being sold there, and that became a very important market for the business sector because of the proximity to the bridge, and we have a large volume of people coming across from Piedras Negras with limited amount of funds. They don't have cars, but they want some of the items in the U.S. and they sell basically really cheap products and volume and make a profit.
Tell me that the story of the turmoil with that county judge Enriqueta Diaz Lane. What was all that controversy about, those lawsuits and indictments and things?
Well, Keta is a very colorful character. She is described by anybody who's ever sat down and talked to her as a very intelligent woman, but she is super aggressive, and she has also been described by some as being crazy, because she does tend to be on the eccentric side. She got elected through a lot of hard work and by Judge Bowles not paying attention, thinking that he was unbeatable, and that if he was that strong, then how could someone like Keta beat him? But as I was talking about some of the problems in the community, especially at the county level, that have not been addressed, and so people voted for Keta, and she won, and there was some allegations of voter fraud. Judge Bowles took his election contest to district court and eventually dropped it, because part of this is the same system that trabajadoras manipulate votes, and the mail-in system is one of the key areas where the trabajadoras concentrate, because what they do is they go out to the elderly and get them to sign the request and for a mail-in ballot, and the ballot is picked up intact by the voters, trabajadoras from voters, and then given to the candidates to vote how they see fit. And it was alleged by Judge Bowles that Keta did this, but both factions did. And the way that Keta was able to do this was that she had married Dick Lane, an engineer, and through a divorce settlement came into a lot of money. And she was able to finance her campaign and play their game to get elected. And so she came into the post under what they claim to be is a questionable manner, but it's basically she played their game and beat them. And so all throughout her tenure, there was a lot of pressure on her to try to make her fail. And she was constantly in the news, and because of her character, she sometimes acted in a way that a public relations firm would have a heart attack, that she insulted people on a personal level, accused Judge Bowles of beating his wife, of our DA of being hooked on cocaine, and so she was very, 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 very abrasive. And in one of those instances where she was at odds with the county attorney, apparently some files were pending before her court that the county attorney was going to be prosecuting were missing. Eventually those files were found in her office's bathroom under the sink. She was indicted for I forget what the actual charge is, I think it probably, I don't remember what the specific charge was, but it was tampering with government records or something to that effect. And when she was under indictment, the county attorney then filed a petition for removal because of the indictment. And she was removed by a visiting judge, Clausen, and eventually was found guilty of tampering with government records, and that case is under appeal. She ran for re-election as a writing candidate and lost. And she spent all her money and trying to get reelected, and eventually had to move out of town and lost her family, her ex-husband, because of her situation. She didn't have any income and couldn't support her daughter, and lost custody of her daughter, and she moved out of town and hasn't been back since.
You work for Texas Rural Legal Aid?
Yes.
What role has Texas Rural Legal Aid played here in Maverick County? What cases have they been involved in? What kind of services? What's the impact of TRLA?
Well, I think probably the area in which has been most significant is on farm labor cases. We have a segment of legal aid office that is devoted to migrant issues and farm labor cases in specific. And we've been able to change some of the practice here locally in terms of people getting paid minimum wage and actually getting paid for their labor. I think that on a social level, that probably has been one of the most significant. I think in terms of economics, I think the other area is in terms of Social Security. I can't speak for the rest of South Texas, but I know that we have a hard time qualifying people for disability benefits, and specifically SSI, and because we're dealing mostly with people who are ex-farm workers and migrants who don't have a work base under Social Security, and mostly have to qualify through disability or is there just on need for SSI. And the number of people that we've been able to successfully represent and get benefits translates into millions of dollars. And really it helps people they survive through their old age and through disability. When had legal aid not been available, that representation would have not been there, and these people would have had a very hard time surviving. I think those two areas are some of the more significant. We've sued I think every governmental entity here. I sued the school district on their admissions policy, where they were denying students admission because they were not residing with their parents. Where we had people who, because of the proximity to the border, having relatives from Piedras Negras who were unable to support their children financially, taking them to Eagle Pass and having somebody, a relative on this side, support them and live with them, then being denied access to school because they allegedly they were here for school purposes only. And we were able to secure a settlement in which now there is an individual assessment that in the past, if you were not living with your parents, you were deemed to be living in the school district for the sole purposes of attending school. And now they have an individual assessment that they conduct before they admit a student who's not living with his parents. We sued the...
Excuse me, before we go on to the other kind of case, is that a financing problem, as Brownsville ISD alleges, or La Jolla in the Pasco District alleges?
Well, it can be a financing problem in terms of this, these children being here, and the parents residing elsewhere, not paying taxes into the district specifically. It's deemed to be a problem because we're on the border, and it's alleged that people just send their children to school here, but yet they will be returning to their parents over the weekend or maybe even every day. And the impact, financial impact, I don't think is that great. I don't think the numbers are that significant, at least at the time we sued the district. We were talking about some 200 to 300, I don't remember specifically, 200 to 300 students that were in limbo at the time. And but because of state aid and stuff, because most of these children are monolingual Spanish and receive the school district receives both state and federal subsidies for providing an education for this children. I don't think it's that great an impact financially, and I really don't think at this particular point in time that these, I guess these past 10 to 12 years that anybody on the school board here locally considers that a problem.
You were going to talk about another legal area, and I interrupted you to clear this up. You recall?
We sued the county as the on as the jail standards as the at the time was one of the first cases that I filed in Maverick County. We had an old jail and it was just very bad condition.
Is this the state court or federal court?
State court.
Mm-hmm. So you get the truncated districts where you got your representative out of Alpine, your senator out of San Antonio, your district judges and your district attorney are out of Zavala County. How does that work out?
That really hasn't been a problem. I think we have very similar interest, and I think Judge Perez is an excellent judge. I think he's done a very good job in trying to meet the needs of Maverick County, because most of the cases are here in Maverick County. That's really the only difference between the area that. We have very similar perceptions of justice in the area. This area is plaintiff oriented, and I was talking to a defense lawyer out of San Antonio who said he hated to try a case in the DMZ zone, Dimmitt, Maverick, Zavala, and I think that they've been able to assess the needs of the general population and dispensing justice, that it hasn't been a problem.
Well, are those comments applicable to the other judge, Abascal?
To a certain extent, yes. I think he is a little bit more laid back and hasn't been as active as Judge Perez, but Judge Abascal has been there only for one term, so it's hard to assess.
And the district attorney, Robert Serna?
Well, Mr. Serna had his ups and downs regarding corruption issues, regarding his staff that may have made his tenure rocky, but I think in the overall situation, I think the quality of his work in terms of convictions and getting at those cases which merit more attention, such as violent crime and stuff, I think he's done a good job.
We were talking about issues. You mentioned economic development and we haven't gotten back to that. You have mentioned other issues before. Are there any other stated issues that are on the horizon?
I think one of the interesting ones, which I think is on the back burner right now, but I think in terms of politics along the border, is the coal mine that is there. Finally got its permit from the state of Texas, but because the primary investor, which is alleged to be Carlos Salinas de Gortari, is having his political problems, there hasn't been any movement on that. But I think this is one of the areas, just one of the areas in which small communities along the border are pawns in these international deals, in which we have the coal mine issue coming up in Piedras Negras. It's called El Tajo Norte. And because the owners of the property where the Tajo Norte was going to be operated fell out of favor with the PRI, and Carlos Salinas getting his people lined up and working on this side of the border, El Tajo Norte was a big issue of pollution and concern about the environment in Piedras Negras, and the coal mine was the issue was defeated in Piedras Negras politically. Then we have the issue coming up on this side, and the same Mexican investors that we were talking about the bridge trying to influence local politics into supporting the mine and not being concerned about the environmental issues came into play. And not only did they come into play regarding the mine, but we have the environmental side of it on the natural gas issue also coming into play, where we have Southern Union Gas, which is out of Missouri and here in Texas, out of Austin, buying our local gas company and trying to influence the Mexican government to switch from having a coal-burning energy plant in Carbón Dos and switching over to a natural gas burning, and Eagle Pass being caught in the middle. We were going to be supplying the coal, and the local gas company was also going to be supplying the natural gas. And we have two competing interests, all influencing what happens here locally and the impact on the local economy being just a forgotten issue for these multinational companies. And so one of the I think big issues in the future of Eagle Pass is being able to control our own industry and politics, and having a role in what happens to us is really something that is very important for us here locally, that we don't want to be caught in the middle of other people's battles. And if something is going to happen, we want to say so.
Who do you think are the more important leaders in the state for Mexican Americans and the organizations?
Well, I think that we're looking at being optimistic and hoping Victor Morales gets elected, and having someone who's fresh in the politics, who hasn't been corrupted by a system yet, being able to have some impact and how things are done. Of course, Henry Cisneros always plays a part in everything that happens here locally. Choco Gonzalez, who is from Eagle Pass, went to work for him up in HUD, so he visits us on a regular basis. I think we've seen him at least twice a year since he left the mayor's position. He always comes down, and I think local politicians use him as a contact anytime something needs to be done in Washington and even at the state level. I think that these are some of the perceived as having an impact on Hispanic issues and here locally. I think what we need is more homegrown talent and people who are more inclined to the border and rural issues, which I think is tending to be minimized as the Dallas, Houston, Hispanic influence continues to grow. And I think here locally we've been losing out. I think the colonias issue is very important, and while I may disagree with some of Dan Morales' actions, I think that as long as he's our Attorney General, that I think we necessarily have to keep him in mind and trying to see how we're going to resolve the colonias issues.
Is LULAC active in America? Yeah. GFO? MAD?
No.
National Council of the Raza?
No.
Just TRLA?
Just TRLA. And we've had some of these the organizations have had a very short-lived presence at particular points of time. The National Council of La Raza 2 years ago was influential in getting the Winter Garden Border Area Alliance started. Alejandro Perez, a prior, and people around the area being participants in trying to see something, a plan for this area to be promoted at state and federal levels. But we get started and then we fizzle out.
Okay. Wrapping this thing up, we've just about covered everything. We haven't talked too much about the school, but you said it was all part and parcel of the same factions. The one group controls or the other group controls.
It was right now what we have is the majority of the school board are city employees. And these city employees are controlled by the city faction. They have the majority on the city council. So basically, the local newspaper calls the school district the City of Eagle Pass Independent School District. And part of the problem that we're going to have to address is trying to open up the system to a broad-based representation of all segments of the community, because right now it's very limited. We have I would say about 15 families that over the past 15 years have occupied 90% of all the elected officials, elected offices, and that patron system changed hands from being one of controlled by Anglos to one being controlled by Mexicanos, but yet the problems with the patron system and corruption all the problems associated with that just change hands, and we need to change the way government operates. Accountability is a big issue that we want to see in government. That while in the past we wanted access to government and being able to hold a position, I think at this point now we need more accountability in terms of issues and the process utilized to resolve some of these problems.
There's a lot of students from Eagle Pass that go to the community college in Uvalde. Any plans to ask them to enlarge the district or to be annexed and be part of that decision making?
it's been discussed in the past, but as I was saying about Eddie Rodriguez and Middle Rio Grande and how politics are decided in the area, I don't think that there's really any movement at this particular point in time from any faction to see that materialize. And until we get something a little bit more concrete in terms of change in the community, I don't think it's in the very near future.
Any final comments about politics in Maverick County?
Well, politics in Maverick County has gotten black eye, especially last 4 or 5 years, we've been in San Antonio papers, Texas Monthly, Wall Street Journal, and we've been bad-mouthed by people who don't know about the local struggles and what the vast majority of this town is striving to achieve in politics. We have some very difficult obstacles to overcome, but we are working to try and to change that, and I'm certain that change is just ahead, and in the very near future, I hope that we can put the negative aspect of politics of Maverick County in the history books and start building on a new type of system for the border area.
You gonna run again?
It's always a possibility. No, no, vamos, Alejandro. My father used to say that the family the motto is "Los Riojas nunca se raja." We don't quit, and we're gonna go forward. And we've been making progress over the years. We've doubled the number voters that have supported us. We've broken election records for the county, and one of these days we're gonna break the record in terms of numbers of years in service.
All right, well, we thank you for almost an hour and 40 minutes of talk. It was good talk.